Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Lauren Gibbons and Craig Mauger. A little later, we've got some folks brought to us from the state of Tennessee by Ed Trust Midwest to talk about education policy and what we can be doing in the state to help on those ends because of their successes they've had in the green state of Tennessee. But first, Craig, last week the big news was the Rhodes deal is on a hiatus, on an impasse. Things are not moving along right now. Do you get the sense, or are you starting to get the sense, that maybe there's some folks in that quadrant meeting that don't necessarily want to get a deal done?
I don't know if it's that they don't want to get a deal done, but I think some of those folks are realizing how big some of the hurdles are to getting something done with an election looming in 2016, with the issue like of prevailing wage out there, with this battle over what the tax relief should be out there, and so many other differences still looming. It seems like we've got a house of cards built here, and it could fall over if a strong breeze comes through. Breeze, for that matter.
Somebody just kind of blowing on it. You know, it's hard to imagine that any talk about an income tax cut or any type of cut as far as taxes are concerned wasn't brought up before in any of these meetings, right? You would think that at some point this conversation had happened, and maybe the Democrats just have never signed off, and now it became vocal that, hey, you know, we're not going to support a tax cut. But they're saying the numbers just don't work. The budget numbers are as the budget numbers are and can't pay for a tax cut the way things stand right now.
It's highly suspicious because we've had these numbers of 800 and 400 for the breakdown of what would be new revenue and what would be existing revenue for weeks. I mean, the media has been reporting on this, us and others, for a long time. And now all of a sudden, oh, this income tax thing, it came out of nowhere and stopped our negotiations. It's like that's had to have been something they were talking about for a while. So who knows what really happened in that room? Only they do.
As far as political concerns are concerned, and just purely political concerns, Craig, do the House Democrats necessarily need a road funding fix going into the 2016 elections?
Do the House Democrats need a fix?
Yeah.
I don't think for political purposes that they have to have a fix. I mean, I think talking to lawmakers from across the spectrum, the feeling is that the House Republicans need to get something done, probably more likely than the Democrats do, because when you're in majority, the burden of leadership is on your shoulders.
You're supposed to be the one who governed. Going back to 2007, when there was that income tax vote, and Andy Dillon held everybody on the chamber for weekends and days, and people were sleeping on the floor. And in the end, where did Andy Dillon have to get his income tax votes from? From his own caucus. And so now you wonder, at what point is it going to be obvious that if the Republicans want to get something done, maybe they got to get something done with their own 54 votes?
And that's something some House Republicans have been talking about for a while, that they've kind of said, you know, privately, hey, we should be working on our own plan because we don't trust that these Democrats are in this for the long haul, because they're going to throw, you know, they're alleging that they're going to start throwing all these things as part of the deal on the table at the last minute to blow it up. So some Republicans feel that their caucus should just be working on their own plan right now.
And if you take a look at what the Democrats are asking for here, it's not necessarily huge asks, considering that for them to put up their own votes for any type of gas tax increase or driver registration fee, you would think, hey, if we're going to come to the table and supply votes for your plan, then we got to get something out of it, because the House Democrats came out with their own plan and none of their plan is in this final plan, right?
That we know of yet.
Right. Yeah, as far as we know yet, because the House Democrats' plan was basically, let's tax businesses. There's none of that in this final compromise that people are talking
about. It doesn't appear that way, no.
So if they're not getting anything out of this negotiation as far as what the structure of this looks like, if they don't get prevailing wage taken off the table, and if they don't have concerns about the budget taken care of, you know, what are they getting out of this?
I think the concerns about the budget, there's a potential that maybe these cuts could be defined in some way going forward, what funds are going to be shifted to roads. There's been some talk that maybe they'll get one of the tax credit changes that they wanted. I mean, those are things that are on the table. But I think a lot of Democrats want this prevailing wage issue connected to this, and the quadrant hasn't even got to that point yet, and it hasn't been pitched. This plan that they're working on hadn't even been pitched to a regular House Democratic member who's really fired up about prevailing wage.
Let's talk about the governor's office here and how unusual this would be if they were to sign off on an income tax cut as part of this road funding deal and not have it specifically designated where that money is coming from. That is very unlike this accountant-like governor. Just looking at his past track record, seems to me like even the smallest tax cut, like the income or the sales tax on the difference on those automobiles, that had to get stretched out into practically infinity in order for him to sign off on it because you couldn't find where in the budget the money was coming from. Now, all of a sudden, if you put an income tax cut on the table, it would seem like he would have to be comfortable signing off on it and where that money was coming from before he would say okay, right? Wouldn't you think?
And it's interesting that I don't think we really know where he is on that income tax thing yet. I mean, I don't think he said it publicly. I asked him after one of the quadrant meetings 2 weeks ago, I said, how important is tax relief to you as part of this plan? And he completely answered a totally different question that I hadn't asked about he just talked about how the road deals are going overall. So he could have easily just said, it's very important.
And
he did not say that.
So no. It's obviously not important. So it makes you wonder, is Snyder necessarily heartbroken that things are on a stall right now because of this income tax question?
I think he might not be passionate about the income tax cut, but I think he's looking at this and he's saying, I need to get something done soon. I need to get something done in October or November if I want to get the roads fixed, because in 2016 it's going to be very challenging. And in December it could be really challenging because prevailing wage could be before the legislators sometime around that time, and it will be much more divisive in the Capitol when that issue is at the feet of lawmakers to decide. So I think Snyder's looking at this and saying, man, I got to do something quickly here. And now he's throwing a DPS plan into the mix, and some other big matters are starting to come out.
Well, let's move across the chamber here, Lauren, to this DPS issue and what likely is going to start in the Senate, because Jeff Hansen has been talking about this. So here we have an issue like presumptive parole that the Senate doesn't want to touch at all, and now we get DPS thrown in here as well. This is going to be a really tough issue for them, don't you think?
Right. It has, it's been something that's, at least with DPS, that has been on the minds of senators a little bit. They've already, been talking amongst themselves, trying to figure out, where they stand on it, what their concerns are. Presumptive parole has come out, and that has been in the House for so long, and all the lobbying efforts and the informational sessions have been over there. So now, they have an issue that they just don't necessarily know what to do with yet. A lot of them have concerns. Some people have come out and already said that they oppose it quite a bit. It's risen tensions a little bit in the criminal justice arena.
Right, and so it looks like presumptive parole, at least in the short term and maybe the long term, is going to get sat on in the Senate. However, this DPS issue isn't getting any better here with the debt. And is there some culpability on the end of the state here? You get an EM in, an emergency manager into Detroit Public Schools, they rack up this huge debt. The senators have to feel like, well, geez, the state actually has to come up with something on this since this happened under our watch.
I don't think that anyone in the Senate is saying they shouldn't act on something. Mikoff has come out and said, this is a priority for him going into the fall to try and figure out the right direction for this. Where that direction is quite headed at this point, that hasn't been made as clear.
But we do know that Jeff Hansen is kind of leading the charge on this issue. The governor wants to get this thing done by the beginning of the next school year. That kind of seems like a tall order, doesn't it?
It does. It does, especially with so many differing opinions on, how this should be handled, how this was handled. It could drag out here.
And then you're looking at the legislative side. Where are the legislative Detroit Democrats on this? They're not in love with the governor's plan for other reasons.
Right. And for completely different reasons, as they have made pretty clear throughout.
And because, Craig, the Detroit lawmakers don't want to be the ones that say, oh, we'll take money from all you other districts to help us out. They want this to be new money. They don't want this to be something that they're taking from other school districts, because that doesn't look good and it hurts their ability to get the votes needed to to get money over to the city of Detroit.
And there's the whole issue of control. Who's going to have a say? Who's going to have the power to run this new system that Snyder's talking about setting up? I don't think the Detroit lawmakers want to be seen as giving the power over to the state even any more than it already is. I think that's another big hurdle for this package to jump. It's going to be interesting because if this gets compared to the grand bargain a lot. Snyder was talking about that apparently today, how this may be similar. But just following policy in the Capitol, education policy is debated so heavily. There's so many interest groups on every side. It's going to be really challenging to get something this meaningful, this wide-ranging through the legislature, I think, especially by the start of next school year. You've got charter school groups who want their side to have more power in Detroit. You've got traditional education groups that want those groups not to have the power that they currently have. So it's this huge tug of war. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
And then also, this is a little bit of an indictment on the emergency manager process. What happens when you have an EM in place? Something bad happens. Yeah. In the case of DPS, we had the district fall into debt, $500 million plus. Mm-hmm. And then in the city of Flint, a decision was made to hook them up to a water supply that wasn't safe. And so now you get the state involved, and theoretically and in most cases, the state helps take care of things and they get the books balanced. But what happens, Craig, when things don't go right?
I know. It's interesting. Is the state about to set some type of precedent in the next year for when an emergency manager does something or something wrong happens under an emergency manager? Is the state about to set a precedent that the legislature is left holding the bag because of what these gubernatorially appointed emergency managers do? If the state comes in and helps Flint's situation with the water in a big financial way, like it appears that it's doing, or if the state steps in and helps the DPS resolve its debt, you're kind of saying that these things that happen under these emergency managers, the state is somewhat liable for them.
It kind of gives you a bad taste in your mouth if you're a lawmaker, like, geez, do we really want to be sending these EMs all over the place?
Who are these guys, and what are they deciding? Maybe we should have some say in this. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes on that. It's a very interesting topic you bring up. Let's get on to the next part of the podcast. Joining me for the podcast now is Sarah Habern. She is the Executive Director for the Tennessee State Board of Education. And Mark Hill, he serves as the Chief Policy Officer at the Nashville Area Chamber of Commerce. They are the guests of EdTrust Midwest, talking about education reforms in the state of Michigan. You guys came at a very good time here with third grade reading legislation and the teacher evals being hot in the legislature right now. Welcome to Michigan, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thanks for having us.
The EdTrust Midwest folks wanted to bring you all in to town to talk about the Tennessee story. Why should we be looking at Tennessee as a model for reforms that we could be doing here in Michigan? Why don't you start, Sarah?
Yeah, well, it's been a great chance for us to reflect together on some of the progress that we have made as a state. I think we acknowledge, first and foremost, that we still have a long way to go. Fastest improving is not where we want to stop. We want to see more results for students and continue to grow in achievement measures. But we are pleased to say we are a state on the move, I like to say. And I think over the last few years, we've seen some historic growth, particularly measured by NAEP, the National Assessment for Student Progress. And, I think there are a number of elements that we've been focused on in Tennessee that have helped to contribute to that growth. So happy to talk through some of
those
with you today.
So when you talk about growth, where was Tennessee and where are you now?
It's a great question. So again, if you're looking at the National Assessment for Education Progress, NAEP, back in the early 2000s and up until our most recent results that were released in 2013, we were at the very bottom. We were 48, 49, depending on whether you're looking at fourth grade reading and math or eighth grade reading and math. When the 2013 came out, it was 2011 was the, it's every 2 years. So the most recent results that have been released, we're expecting the latest results actually any week now. Mm-hmm. We leapfrogged and made great gains into the mid-40s. So we're still in the bottom half, but we made the most progress ever seen in between administrations of NAEP.
So does Tennessee just got smarter kids now, or what did you guys do from a policy standpoint?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll lean on Mark here as well, my colleague who can speak from the business community's perspective. But I think we focused on a couple key elements. Namely, we got serious about raising standards for students, and that started back in 2007 when we got a pretty big wake-up call from the Leaders and Laggards report by the National Chamber that said, truth in advertising, our student assessments in Tennessee told us one thing, that all of our students essentially were proficient or advanced, and the National Assessment on Progress said something very different. Only a quarter of our students were proficient or advanced. So in response, we changed our standards and raised our expectations for students in the form of new student standards, the American Diploma Project, and that was back in 07. We then continued that trajectory with the Common Core, now what we refer to as the Tennessee State Standards in 09, raised standards again.
So you guys do use Common Core?
We are in the process of refining it and making it more Tennessee-specific. We have a review process actually underway that I'm happy to talk about, but in 09, we adopted the Common Core state standards, yes.
Well, wasn't there any Republican pushback to that?
At the time, it was part of our Race to the Top plan, and it made sense. We were continuing to raise standards again like we had started in 07, and we actually had bipartisan support for those changes, allowed us to get the Race to the Top grant. We made a lot of significant improvements as a state when we got that grant beginning in 2010. And again, I think it was higher standards. I think it was really looking at the nucleus of education and the teacher in the classroom and what kind of differentiated supports did we need to offer our teachers. And having the lens of a teacher evaluation system with multiple measures that looked at teacher impact on student performance really made a difference in our ability to give differentiated supports to teachers as we move forward with those implementations.
And Mark, why don't I ask you about Common Core? Because here in Michigan, Common Core is a stinky political football that nobody really wants to touch or tackle. How did you get through that in Tennessee and avoid it from being something like that?
Yeah, the importance from the business community standpoint is that we're actually preparing students to be successful in college or career after they leave school. That means having rigorous standards in place. So Common Core fulfilled that requirement, that need to have rigorous standards. But frankly, there was a lot of misinformation about sort of where that came from and what was behind Common Core. And so I think the state, smartly in Tennessee, has engage Tennessee educators to revise those standards, as Sarah said, make them more Tennessee-specific. From the standpoint of the business community, what we care about is that the standards are rigorous, that we don't back up, we don't water them down, we don't go back to the time in Tennessee where we lied to our graduates and said they were prepared for college when they really weren't. So we have been watching the legislature and state policymakers to make sure we don't back up on the rigorous nature of those standards, no matter what we decide to call them.
Now, Sarah, third grade reading is a topic that's hot here in Lansing. Have you guys done something similar in the state of Tennessee by saying that if you're not able to read by the third grade, you're going to flunk?
We don't have any legislation of that kind at the moment. We certainly have looked a lot at early literacy and are continuing to refine our strategies there. I think research will show you that those are critical points of development for students, and yet we don't know a lot about what really works in those early grades. So our posture in Tennessee has been to make sure all teachers have differentiated supports and have interventions for students early and often through the RACE or RTI, response to intervention model that we use in Tennessee for students. And we're continuing to evolve our plans, particularly for early literacy. We know that we want to get serious about the teaching of reading. That means we need to partner more closely with teacher prep to ensure that teachers coming into those grades understand that from day one about the science behind teaching reading. And give similar supports and interventions in those early grades.
Now, did you guys get any Race to the Top money in Tennessee?
We did. We were one of the first states to receive Race to the Top money.
How has that impacted the progress that you've seen?
It gave us a jump start on some things that we wanted to do already as a state. It certainly gave us the seed money to do some at-scale training when we rolled out the Common Core state standards. Similarly, with our teacher evaluation system, we did direct evaluator training and certification and used some of that money. Data systems were another thing that we used a lot of that money for to make sure that we could collect accurate information about what was happening in our districts to support them, again, in thinking about strong implementation of some of the reforms. But we are now on the other side of that grant. That we were one of the first states to receive it in 2011. And so
you're not receiving the money now?
No.
Right. Was it a one-time? How does that work?
Yes, it was very clear that it was going to be a one-time.
Okay. How much
grant.
Was it?
We got $500 million as a state.
And half a billion?
Half a billion.
What do you do with $500 million?
You know, $500 million sounds like a lot of money until you spread it across an entire state over a four-year period, and then it becomes not
as much
money.
It's still a fraction of the education budget.
Yeah, it's astonishing as it may sound, a drop in the bucket. What it did do is catalyze some much-needed change. So that grant, in order to compete for that successfully, we had to reform some of our education systems, some of our statutes in state law. And that was the real value of getting the Race to the Top, is that it helped push us and propel us towards a much-needed change in education.
Well, what do you think was the most important change that was made in Tennessee, Mark?
I'll say from the business community, it was the fact that we rarely, if ever, evaluated our educators. And what I mean by evaluation, not in a punitive sense, but give them real-time feedback on their instructional practices and then coaching them to improve. We didn't do much of that. I mean, you had to have, as a teacher, evaluation 3 times every 10 years, but no one really followed up to make sure that was happening.
3 times every 10 years?
If it happened at all. And we moved to a system where there's annual evaluation, and it's a series of several observations and feedbacks between an administrator and a teacher to help that teacher improvement. We do that in the private sector all the time. We have performance evaluations. We have coaching. We have mentoring. We help employees improve and reach goals. For some reason, we didn't think we needed to do that in education. That was a huge lever for us in seeing some of the gains we've seen.
Now, Sarah, here in Michigan, it seems like the teacher evaluation bill has gotten a bit contentious. We may have a deal now in the House and Senate. It's taken a long time, though. What was the politics in Tennessee like as far as getting a teacher evaluation bill through?
So the bill itself, actually, for us was easier because we were all aligned in terms of the support for Race to the Top, and that was a big part, like Mark said, of getting that grant was our assurance to the feds that we would implement a rigorous multiple-measure evaluation system that took feedback seriously for teachers.
So the money was kind of a unifying force.
It was, but I'll tell you, the first year of implementation was really hard, and so just the fact that people signed on in theory did not mean that the actual implementation was easy. It was anything but. And that first year, we heard a lot from our educators, pushback from principals saying this is too much time, teachers saying this isn't fair, some of the measures don't make sense. I mean, we heard it all, and it was loud and ugly. But our governor stepped in and said, you know, no evaluation system is perfect, but this is one that we're going to continue to make better, and we're not going to pass legislation this first year to roll it back. We're going to do a serious listening campaign. We're going to collect data. We're going to ask the Department of Education to issue a report on what's working and what needs to be changed. And we did all of that. After the first year, we issued a major report saying, here's what we're hearing, here's what we're seeing that's working, and here's where we need to make changes. And we also, at the end of that first year, saw some historic growth on our state assessments. So not only were people getting feedback, they were getting better at instruction, and it showed very readily in our student results even after that first year.
So do you think you can make a direct correlation to improved scores from students and the teacher evaluation bill actually having been implemented?
So I've had enough statistics classes and research methods that, no, I would not make that assumption. But okay. We do think that was one of the big things that changed in addition to higher standards. And we do believe that these collective efforts have enabled us to make some real progress.
One more question, if I could, about your teacher evaluation standards. Here in Michigan, one of the original proposals had actual vendors named in the legislation. Did you guys go that far, or how did you dictate to the locals what kind of evaluation system they were going to use?
Yeah, I kind of describe it as a loose, tight approach. The law was very high level in terms of some of the parameters that should be included, the fact that all teachers needed annual observations and feedback, and that those results would be used at the local level to inform personnel decisions. But then it directed the state board, where I currently work, to create a lot of the policy that put sort of flesh on the bone of that sort of high level law. And the policy is more nimble. We've been able to make adjustments to the policy as we've learned more through implementation. And then the Department of Education really was charged with helping to support and oversee implementation of the system. So it was, again, sort of a loose, tight. The law was pretty loose but clear about some specific parameters, and then was further defined in policy and practice.
Thanks, Mark Hill, for joining us today, and Sarah Habern. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Lauren, we were going to play the MSU fight song to start off the podcast, but we didn't because we didn't want to chase away our U of M friends and listeners.
Yeah, I can see some Michigan fans having a bad taste in
their
mouth.
So let's just go ahead and play it right now.
Yes. I think it's okay.
And you know what? I'm going to bet that Michigan wins by 21 points, by 4 touchdowns every time they play from now on.
Hey, yeah, it seems to work out pretty well. I've never been more glad to see you proven so wrong.
You know what? I will continuously pick Michigan State to lose football games, Craig, because for as long as you've known me, I continue to do it, and they continue to win.
I know. It's bold, though. All I know is that you thought your team was going to lose, though. I think legitimately in your heart you thought they were going to lose.
Well, I think everybody thought they were going to lose, right? Up until not with 10 seconds left.
Well,
left to go in the game, you knew they were going to lose, right?
I have. Oh, yeah. I think I was already preparing myself for a heartbreaker, and then, you know, everybody was freaking out. I had to sit down after that happened because my heart rate was going so fast.
At least you weren't like WZZM or our friend Jerry Crandall, who printed that Michigan had won the game.
Right. Don't want that.
That's something we don't want. All right. Well, very good. Thanks for joining us on this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Lauren and Craig. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullane. Take care.